You're listening to Psych Talk.
On this Psych Talk podcast, we're speaking with Matt Trujillo. He's a doctoral student at Princeton in the joint degree program of psychology and social policy. He conducts research on ethnic identity and prejudice with Nicole Shelton and Joel Cooper. He's originally from Phoenix and attended Arizona State University as an undergrad. He has joined us on Psych Talk to talk about his research on ethnicity and census participation. Here we go.
So one focus of yours is what you call ethnic miscategorization. And just tell us what it is.
Right. So ethnic miscategorization is essentially the instance in which somebody has their ethnicity misperceived by another individual. So if you happen to be of Chinese descent, it's when people think you're Japanese or Korean. Or if you happen to be Puerto Rican, when people think you're Mexican. Kind of this disconnect between what you yourself identify as and how other people identify you.
Sure. And you came up with that term, right?
I did. Mm-hmm. In psychology, categorization, particularly in social psychology, is a big thing. We talk about how people categorize individuals, how they categorize objects, how they categorize mm-hmm. groups. And so I felt like categorization would be a kind of good term to use, given that it's kind of prevalent in our discipline.
Right. So sort of a conformist way to come up with the term.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I'm not really at a period where in my career where I can start kind of branching away from what other people have done.
Sure. So ethnic miscategorization is very clear. It happens to me as a white-looking person who's Hispanic, so I understand what it is. But I do wonder if you have a read on how often it happens or like where it's more likely to happen, like country-wise or just within a town.
Certainly. I mean, so I don't have, as of yet, an objective measure of how often it happens. That's actually something I'm working on. What I do know from my research is that as of right now, it appears to happen more with Latino and Asian individuals. One reason why I believe this happens is that because there are many different subgroups, sub-ethnic groups within this broader terms of Latino and Asian.
Yeah.
So like I said, it would occur when Mexicans get confused for Puerto Ricans and vice versa, or when Japanese individuals are confused for being Chinese.
Right.
And so it tends to happen more along that, and it does not seem to happen as much with, you know, Caucasian and African-American individuals. So there seems to be some distinction across kind of race and ethnicity.
All right, so you have this construct, and it applies a little more to some subgroups of people than others.
Right.
Now, tell us how you have looked at it in experiments. I think you focused on miscategorization among Asians. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so tell us like what the setup of a typical experiment would be that you've recently worked on.
Typically, how I do this is I will bring – so historically, I've been using Asian participants or Asian-American participants, rather. Mm-hmm. So I'll bring these participants into the lab. And using kind of sleight of hand, we can go into more details if you would like, but I essentially convince these participants that there is somebody else in a different room and that this other person thinks that they are an ethnicity that they are in fact not. I do this by showing the quote-unquote other participant a picture of the actual participant. So they believe that there's somebody else looking at a picture of them and that based off this picture, they make a conclusion. This ostensible other participant makes a conclusion about their ethnicity, and that this conclusion is often wrong for the purposes of a study. Mm-hmm. And then I see how people essentially react to this experience.
Yeah. So just to give an example, if I were Japanese, I would walk in, I'd be told there's someone else in another room doing the experiment with me, and I have a picture taken, and then it's supposedly shown to my partner, and then I see whether they thought I was Japanese or Chinese or something else.
Right.
I'm either miscategorized or not, depending on the condition.
Right. Yeah, I say that the quote-unquote other partner is going to be seeing your picture because we want to look at first impressions and how accurate is this other person's impression of you based off of this picture. And part of the impression that the person makes is the impression about what ethnicity you are.
Right.
And so this person will either get it for half the people, get it correct, or for the other half, get it incorrect and guess that you were something else that you're not.
It's interesting that the study uses deception because I think people definitely come into psychology studies not expecting deception ever. But I think when there's a promise of a partner, it's a little more likely that there's something like that involved. I don't want to give like a spoiler on all of social psychology experiments.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm lucky to be running this particular study at Princeton because, in fact, Princeton, we have a lot of studies on like interactions, static interactions between two individuals that really do use other people.
Okay.
And oftentimes we actually have them in separate rooms and eventually bring them together. So more often than not, at least in Princeton, if you're told you're going to be interacting with somebody else, it's the truth. I guess happen to be taking advantage of that.
Yeah.
So I think I'm kind of in a lucky situation being here at Princeton.
Right. So you have people who have been deceived effectively, and now they've either been affirmed or they've been miscategorized.
Right.
Now what happens next when that pulls out information you're going to measure?
Yeah. So essentially that's the manipulation, right? So after the manipulation, you take your dependent measures.
Right.
So oftentimes my measures have been things like affect. So kind of in general, are you upset? Are you angry, annoyed? Sometimes are even amused. Sometimes people are amused by this situation that, well, people can't guess who I am.
Right. And this is all self-report, right? Like numbering on a scale.
Right. Yeah. So you'll get a list of emotions. You rank them on a, well, you don't rank them. You rate them on a scale of 1 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also get attitudes towards the other person, the supposed other person. So are you angry with them? Do you want to interact with them more or less? So just kind of general affect measures. My primary measure, though, one thing I'm particularly interested in is what I call identity assertion.
Hmm.
So when you, as a participant, have your ethnicity misperceived by somebody else, if you're Chinese and somebody thinks you're Japanese, do you react to this experience by asserting your Chinese-ness, if you will? Do you enact behaviors, or in this case, say you will enact behaviors that kind of allow you to assert your Chinese identity after just being confused as a member of a different ethnicity. So I wanted to get kind of just a basic measure of that, because there are some pretty interesting downstream consequences to that just kind of identity assertion type behavior.
So how do you measure identity assertion?
So as of right now, what I've been doing is I've been doing what I call a product preference task.
Mm-hmm.
So further deception, I guess. After we manipulate and we convince people that people think that they're some other ethnicity, we'll give them some basic affect measures. How happy are you? How what are you? So on and so forth. But then we say, oh, there's actually going to be a different study. We're done with the first one. Here's the second study. It's a marketing study. All we're going to have you do is just rate how much you like different products. So you're going to see different pictures of different products. And just tell me on a scale of 1 to 7, do you like it? Will you buy it? Will you use it? These kind of things.
Mm.
Now, it just so happens, because we're psychologists and we're kind of tricky, that a lot of these products are actually associated with the person's individual ethnicity. So if you're Chinese, a lot of the products that you're going to be looking at in this product preference task are going to be Chinese products. Books about Chinese culture, Chinese music, t-shirts that are associated with China. And so what we want to see is, are you going to be more likely to say you're going to use these products and buy these products after somebody just thinks you're, say, Japanese or Korean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we'll get into results for a moment, but one reaction I want to cover that people might have is, that doesn't sound so tricky. I think I would figure it out.
So maybe you
can speak to like what you've done to see whether people are picking up on.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of the whether or not you think to try and figure out if people are actually buying into it. So a lot of it comes in what we call the debriefing. So after the study's done, you certainly take your time to sit down, talk to each participant, find out what was going on in their head.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, these people are going to try to tell you what they think it is. More often than not, to the dismay, they don't get it right. So there's certainly that. There's statistical analysis you can do. So you definitely want to keep track of the statistics, and if anything kind of seems weird for the person, if they think they might get it, you might want to track that and see, does their data look any different than any other person's data? And then there are certain things that you can do within the study itself to kind of either keep people from guessing what's right, or maybe kind of send them in the wrong direction if you know they're going to be guessing something. And so there's just a lot of different tricks of the trade that you do to kind of keep suspicion and, keep the chances of somebody actually accurately guessing what you're looking for low.
Right. Well, I don't want to make you reveal any more trade secrets.
Yeah.
So the conclusions, you have, you're measuring identity assertion, you're measuring affect, and you're either miscategorizing people or not miscategorizing people.
Right.
So then what sort of data do you see coming out of that?
Yeah. So usually, basically, what I've found over a couple studies is that people are actually fairly annoying, I guess you can say. They have a negative affective reaction. So more often than not, people actually are not very happy when their ethnicity is misperceived, as at least in the lab anyway.
Hmm.
But beyond that, perhaps more interesting, people actually tend to assert their identity. So if you believe that somebody else is misperceiving your ethnicity. Mm-hmm. If you're Mexican and somebody just thought you were Puerto Rican, you, as a participant in my study, would be more likely to say that you're going, that you will read Latino literature or Mexican literature, rather.
Right, right.
That you'll watch Mexican cinema, that you'll wear t-shirts that say like Mexican and proud, for example. So in a way, you will actually say anyway that you will use these products. I haven't had a real chance to see if any, I don't have a Mexican and proud t-shirt to see if somebody will wear it.
Right.
As of right now, it's just a matter of what we call behavioral intention. I ask you, would you wear this t-shirt if you could?
Right.
And people are basically more likely to say yes. Mm-hmm. Than they would if they weren't accurately categorized by another individual.
And that's not the only way to do it, right? You could try giving t-shirts.
Yeah. I certainly could try giving t-shirts. That's something I very well may look into in the future. That's something that's a little bit harder to pull off. If anything, just financially, I can't really be making.
You might want to stick to pens or
right,
something.
Right. Yeah. I can't make a lot of t-shirts with the budget, but who knows, maybe I can convince my advisor to throw me a couple more dollars.
Okay, so you found this general pattern, but is there somewhere you see where there's like a need for more research, especially, or like a clear direction in the future for this work to go?
Oh yeah, certainly. So what I've described has been basically my work for the previous, I guess, 3 years. So it's kind of just been my initial grad student work. For my dissertation, I'm going to be following up on this research, specifically by looking at how does status affect this. So what I want to find out is, do people respond either more strongly or less strongly depending on, one, the status of the group? So if you are, say, Chinese, and you perceive Chinese to be a very high status group, much higher than, say, Japanese or Korean, would you react more strongly if people are confusing you as a member of this low status group, right? And does it flip, right? If you actually think Chinese is lower status than people who are Japanese or Korean, would you actually be less upset, right? Because in a way, it could be beneficial to you if people think that you're a member of a higher status group than you actually are. So you might be getting into what we call these passing behaviors, where you actually pass as a member of a different group. So I think there are some interesting implications there. And then that's kind of group status. I also want to look at interpersonal status. So does it matter if the person who's miscategorizing you, is that, if that's your boss or if it's your subordinate, right? So maybe if it's your boss that does it, you might get upset, but you might it might change your behaviors. You may not necessarily want to show your Latino pride right after that, right? So you may have this negative aversive reaction, but it might impact your behaviors. Whereas maybe if you're the boss and it's your subordinate who does it, you might not even care at all, right? Because in a lot of ways, status is shown to buffer a lot of, so people who are a higher status tend to have a less negative reaction to prejudice when it comes from subordinates. So maybe status might serve as a buffer.
That's already been shown, you're saying?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because I think if a boss like wanted to display anger,
right,
they would have more leeway to do that, but they just don't have that reaction.
Yeah. I mean, so in my opinion, I don't necessarily think this has been empirically shown, but in my opinion, so there has certainly been research that shows that people who are higher status, the bosses, if you will, tend to pay less attention to subordinates, and they tend to, you know, have less concern for the subordinate. So in that sense, I think, if anything, while you may feel more agency to react a certain way, you may not even be paying attention. If one of your subordinates does something negatively that could potentially be adverse to you, you may not even notice it. Like, you might notice it, but it might not be that big of a deal to you because you have that buffer of status. So that's one thing I kind of want to see, if this also applies to miscategorization.
Well, Matt, this is all very cool. I'll look forward to hearing how relationships and status affect miscategorization. I want to jump to another research project you've worked on. I think it's been a little bit more on the side. It's not like leading to your dissertation necessarily.
Right.
But I'm going to try to give a little summary and tell me if this sounds about right. Jerry, you can fill something in. So I think you had Latino participants in different states, Arizona, Texas, and New Jersey, watch scenes from a telenovela called Más Sabe el Diablo, or The Devil Knows Best, or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. And the scenes that people watched from this soap opera, basically, were either pro-census scenes or control scenes with the same character. And but there was not the census in those control scenes, right?
Right.
So that was the setup. Take us from there. What was this leading to?
Yeah. Go. Yeah. So certainly. So just kind of a little bit more context. In 2010 was the census, right? Mm-hmm. And what people may not necessarily understand is that the census is very, very important to particular groups, right? So there are what they call hard to count groups. Mm-hmm. So these are various racial groups, ethnic groups. These are also individuals or groups who live in areas that are hard to count. So like a place like New York, very populated in urban areas. But one of these hard to count groups are Latinos, particularly Latinos who speak Spanish.
Who speak primarily Spanish.
Who speak primarily Spanish, yeah, exactly. And in even more so, like we're getting in more degrees of specificity and harder to count, would be immigrants, right? Yeah. Particularly illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
So one thing that's important for these groups to actually participate in the census is that the federal government actually allocates a lot of federal funds depending on the actual numbers of participation within the census.
Right.
So it's important that certain groups participate and everybody does attempt to fill out the census because that means more federal funding for these groups.
We'll go to the
essentially,
area.
Yeah, essentially the areas of which these groups are populated.
Yeah.
Right. And so there was a really big move this year, I guess in 2010, it's not 2010 anymore, to get Latinos, particularly Spanish-speaking Latinos, immigrants to participate in the census. Mm-hmm. Now, the Census Bureau had their work cut out for them, right? Because over the years, you know, the rhetoric across about immigration, about Latino immigrants in particular, has been very, very, you know, divisive, very vitriolic. And so the census had their work cut out for them. But one thing that they thought would work would be to let's get a pro-census storyline in a telenovela. They knew Latinos watch telenovelas. They're very popular. It targets a certain group that they were going for. Mm-hmm. And so they created a census storyline. Particularly, they had a character eventually get a job for the census and become a census recruiter within that telenovela. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we took scenes with that character where she was acting on behalf of the census, very pro-census. And we took scenes. This character was also involved in a love triangle, so we took scenes that with her and her love triangle.
It is a telenovela, so it has to have a love triangle.
Exactly. So it's this. Both scenes had the same character. They were equally, you know, entertaining, and like they kept people's attention equally. The only difference was one was pro-census and one was not pro-census. And we just wanted to see, does this impact how people respond? Do they have greater more positive attitude towards the government, more positive attitudes towards the census, and we actually had some behavioral measures about the census. We didn't measure whether or not they participated. That would have been a little bit too hard to do given the time constraint and everything that we had. So what we did is we measured, I guess we call information-seeking behavior.
Mm.
So we had two things. We had a flyer in Spanish that the census hands out.
Yeah.
And so we offered these flyers to the individuals, and we saw whether or not they took one or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had two stickers. We had a pro-census sticker, and then we had a Latino with Pride sticker in Spanish. And so we saw, what sticker do people take? Do they take the census or the Latino with Pride sticker? And so we had some behavioral measures, though we weren't really able to follow these people to see if they actually participated in the census.
Right. Did you screen them to make sure they'd all like heard of the telenovela before, or you just asked
them
on
spot? We didn't screen them, yeah. So we didn't screen them. We asked them during the survey whether or not they have. A pretty good amount did actually see the survey, or the telenovela. At least they certainly, a good amount said they saw it, and a good amount said they've at least heard of it. So, you would be surprised. I'm not entirely sure whether or not that's pretty standard. I've heard that the telenovela was pretty popular. There were a lot of like groundbreaking things about it. So it seemed like people knew the show well. So it worked out as far as how that goes. It turns out that ultimately the clips we showed were effective whether or not people did see the show or not previously.
Hmm.
It was more effective if they saw the show, but it was effective nonetheless.
Interesting.
Just the clips themselves.
Yeah.
And so we can kind of go into why we think that's the case, but it does appear that just the clips themselves were effective, but more so if you saw the show before and things like that.
Wow. Well, that's really fascinating. I mean, the one thing I wonder about is the effect size, you could say. Like, in other words, maybe if you were funding this telenovela
and you wanted
to know if it was worth your money to change the topic of one show to
census,
you just wanted to, like, have enough of an effect
on Latinos, even though it's
always worthwhile not to undercount groups.
Then
it's like, what could you tell them about, like, how big... This effect was, at least on people's information seeking, just assuming that translates.
So, I mean, I won't necessarily give the, like, the statistic. I don't know if that's...
I mean, that doesn't make sense to most people.
Right. But I definitely would say that just looking at kind of beyond effect size, just at replicability, right?
Mm.
People may not necessarily know this, but there's been a great deal of research looking at telenovelas and their effectiveness at enacting social change or behavioral change, right? And there's a pretty big history of these telenovelas actually being quite successful at getting, you know, behavioral change and social change to go. So there have been telenovelas in Southern America or South America that have led to people kind of taking more classes and reporting more spousal abuse just because telenovelas that they were watching.
More spousal abuse?
Yeah. I think it was in Argentina.
Mm.
There was a telenovela who was trying to get the word out to, you know, if you know spousal abuse is occurring, be sure to report the spousal abuse. And as it so happened, there was more spousal abuse reported because, not necessarily because of it, but it happened to coincide with this. So people tend to believe that maybe the telenovela had a
And I guess it's so hard because you always have correlations.
Right. So, I mean, there are some, you know, techniques that you can do. You know, you can do it, look, you can look at it longitudinally, which makes it a little bit stronger of a case than just a correlation.
Hmm.
So in our example, we actually did an experiment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the experiment kind of takes away some of the, you know, real world validity of it because it's not like people are really watching the show when we measure behavior. We show them clips and we see how they respond afterwards. But really, you just get these studies who are looking at it from all these different perspectives, and all of them seem to be saying that these telenovelas are effective. And even if you look into my co-author, Betsy Pollack, she does research in Africa.
Hmm.
So in the DRC, in Sudan, on radio soap operas. And these radio soap operas have seemed to be pretty effective at getting social change and behavioral change, positive social change to occur. So it seems like this is a pretty effective medium to get people to do things. Yeah, which could be good. I'm talking about, like, the positive sides of things, you know.
Could be propaganda.
Exactly. It could be bad. So. Huh. But it is what it is. Hopefully more good than bad.
Makes me think of what I watch on TV.
Yeah.
Someone's trying to
push
their, I don't know. Huh. Well, okay. So we've talked about two studies, both very interesting, but both related to Latinos, incidentally, in some sense, but pretty distinct. And one of them is leading to your dissertation. So we'll follow up on that. But I don't just want to drill you about your research. So I just wanted to end. We were talking about the value of experiments and how you can, like, actually see a cause come from some variable you manipulate. So let's pretend that we take the dark side of the word manipulate, and you have this, like, dream experiment where you can do anything. And so I guess, not everyone has a classic dream experiment.
Right.
Is there some issue you feel like it'd be easier to get at if you just had all the money in the world and maybe, like, didn't have to get an IRB to sign off on it?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I've always been interested in is this notion of kind of biculturalism, particularly as it pertains to, like, in the American context, right? So America is a very diverse country. Mm-hmm. You have people from a lot of different ethnicities and races and backgrounds, and there are a lot of people who claim to be bicultural, and they very well likely are bicultural. But culture has always been a very hard thing to look at, particularly given the limitations that we have in, you know, IRBs and whatnot, right? Because you can't really take a kid somewhere and put them in a different culture, take them away from their parents, so on and so forth. So I don't necessarily know if I have, like, my dream experiment, but I would definitely know that I would be interested in looking at biculturalism and being able to do some things that I wouldn't really necessarily be able to do you know, trying to get a really good grasp of an experimental manipulation of culture. So mm-hmm. take people and move them to different cultures and see how that goes into how they respond, how they behave.
Right.
And in particular, one thing I'm interested in is I'm not a very neuroscience-y type of person.
Sure.
But one thing I think that would be really interesting to look at would be the neuroscience of culture. Mm-hmm. Particularly because, like I said, culture is a very abstract sense.
Right.
And one thing that we do as psychologists to kind of take these abstract concepts and make them a little harder, if you will, is through neuroscience, right? Like you can see where emotions occur and you can see all these kind of soft things in right. these hard areas of the brain. And so some combination of, you know, manipulating culture, maybe taking people and putting them in different cultures and kind of looking at how does that maybe impact their brain. So kind of right. looking at that with these manipulations, but then on the flip side of the manipulation being the dependent measure being some kind of hard neuroscience-y type of measure. I mean, maybe we can find the cultural side of the brain, I think would be.
That's interesting.
Would be really interesting, yeah. I would never be able to be the person to do it. I mean, ethically we couldn't do it, but even just, I don't have the expertise in neuroscience to do so, but.
Sure, sure. It's funny you say manipulating culture, I just have to say what came to mind, which is like, if you could get people to walk through some kind of scanner that zaps them, they walk out and all of a sudden they like switch from being American to having German culture and right, a German right. sense of humor.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you switch it back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure that could be done.
Yeah, there certainly are. Like there are studies that have been shown to you can manipulate culture, particularly mm. with like bicultural individuals
or bilingual individuals.
Exactly. Yeah, right? yeah, yeah. So one way to do it is through language and things like that.
Mm.
So there is a way to manipulate culture, but it's not. I mean, it's not the perfect right. Like the best way we would be able to manipulate culture would be like pick somebody up and have them grow up in a different culture. Kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, not that we're able to do that, but I would like to see like a real true manipulation of culture, not necessarily
sure.
taking an adult or a young adult who's already kind of bicultural and then
right.
seeing how that works. Like, let's, for better or worse, probably more so worse as far as ethics are concerned, let's actually create culture in somebody and see how that actually impacts, you know, the way they behave and kind of maybe their brain. Maybe the brain actually changes.
Imagine. Well, Matt, I just can't help but ask when we're on this bicultural idea about how much culture you can fit into a person, like tricultural,
right,
four-cultural.
Right.
Like, is it a matter of volume or is it more like just there's half mixing? Or like, how do you think of culture taking part in people and like when they mix together, are they like bringing all aspects of both cultures? And...
Yeah, yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're kind of getting out of the realm of what research I actually know.
Right. I'm just asking you to speculate.
Yeah. I mean, so I actually wonder to the extent of which at one point, maybe like, so cross-generational, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might get a child from a parents of two different cultures, right? Culture, mom is culture X, dad is culture Y, and so you have a cross-culture, you have a bicultural individual
mm-hmm.
child. I can see maybe something like that where like maybe generation one, you have someone that's bicultural.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this person grows up and spends half their life in a certain culture and another half in the other culture. Though I do wonder, to what extent does it cease to be bicultural?
Just a new culture?
Yeah, and it fuses together. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, not to keep going back to Latino culture, but that's kind of, it's who I am, it's what I know.
Yeah.
I wonder to what extent, so I am like fifth, sixth generation from Phoenix. And I honestly feel as if me and people who are like me, you know, very, family's been around for a very long time. We've kind of acculturated. This like Hispanic or Latino American identity is like a separate culture all into itself. It's essentially... our parents might have been bicultural, our grandparents might have been. But at this point, it's like a unified, formed fusion between American and Latino culture that isn't necessarily bicultural anymore. It's one culture, but it's the combination of the two. It's almost the realization of this melting pot mentality.
Yeah.
It's the actual melting pot now. So I do wonder if that's, if that, you know, is occurring. I mean, there's a study there at some point. Maybe
yeah.
I should.
There you go.
I should be writing down what I'm talking about. So I can be writing
out oh, we're recording this. Okay. I hope you didn't say anything you regret.
Yeah.
Matt, thank you so much for talking with me.
Of course.
All right.
Check us out at psychtalkradio.com to find podcasts, contribute ideas, and learn more about each Psych Talk show. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Volunteer to play the trivia challenge by calling 919-438-1927. Thanks for listening.